You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Hi, I'm Chanti.
And I'm Lynx, and you're listening to Muses.
Enjoy the show. Hey, everyone. We're so excited to share our interview with Brita Lee Shane. Brita Lee Shane is the author of the book, Seeing the Real You at Last, Life and Love on the Road with Bob Dylan. She's also an activist and a musician. We loved her book, and after talking to her, I can say that she is smart, funny, fascinating, and totally magical. Yes, Brita has had an intimate relationship with Bob Dylan, and in one of our favorite books we've ever read on the Muses and Stuff show, she writes about that experience. She told us that she traveled around the world, literally and figuratively, with Bob Dylan. We had the opportunity to interview this amazing woman, who was first impressed with Elvis Presley at the age of 7, quickly becoming a member of his fan club. She considers herself a Rolling Stones girl and has had hilarious and synchronistic interactions with Steve McQueen and Frank Zappa, which she tells us about. Brita also wrote a master's thesis, which is published in the British Journal of Educational Psychology, and she's written an article called In the Defense of Yoko Ono, which of course we get into. When we asked Brita what her biggest accomplishments were, she said that they were surviving her childhood and surviving Bob Dylan. Also, we want to congratulate her on the accomplishment of her enduring marriage to her husband of 25 years. We caught up with Brita. She was relaxing in nature, somewhere in California, and dedicating her time and energy to politics and environmental issues. Be sure to check out Postcards to Voters, which she mentions in the episode. She's also co-producing 3 benefit concerts for Rock the Vote and making music. Her latest CD is called What the Heart Wants, and we suggest that you go to her website and buy it right now. If you would like a personally signed first edition copy of her book, you can go to her website, BritaLeeShaneBooksAndMusic.com. We'll put that in the show notes. And one last thing. When she was in a relationship with Bob, he was on tour with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and in this interview, she tells us about it. Like the time Bob asked her to make his set list. Well, he asked her a lot, actually. And this time, she put something on that set list that surprised the Heartbreakers. You don't want to miss this one.
My head is spinning round and round. My feet are flying off the ground. You own my heart, my soul, my skin. You know I wanna be with you. And you can blow my mind if you want to. People watch when we're not looking. Silhouettes flashing in the glass. Hot is hot, they know what's cooking. They know I wanna eat you. And you can blow my mind if you want. wanted.
So, Brita, we like to start our interviews by asking about your childhood. Like, what were you like as a teen and a preteen? What posters did you have on your walls? Were you always a music fan?
I was always a music fan. I grew up, though, I was raised, like, in Topanga Canyon out in the middle of nowhere, so I was sort of a loner. And then when I got to high school, I was, introduced to the Beatles, became popular, and the Rolling Stones, and I was a rebel, so I liked the Rolling Stones actually better at that time than the Beatles. I was just the contrary type that way. But when I was a kid, I was very impressed with Elvis Presley. And then we're talking like from age 7 to 9 or something, because I saw him on the Ed Sullivan Show, and it wasn't the very first show, because that one is the one where they wouldn't show him from the waist down. It was the second one where they showed everything. And even at 7, looking at this guy dancing around the stage, I was just like, oh my God. So I became a member of the Elvis Presley fan club, and somewhere there is a picture of me in an Elvis Presley t-shirt from that time.
Aww. I think that's like every girl's reaction. Yeah.
I definitely remember being 7. And going,
who's this guy? The cute boys.
So
I think he was the first one. They screamed louder than the music. The girls screamed louder than the music, you know?
Yeah, it was more than just about music. It was about the entire experience of seeing something new and, you know, something so fascinating in those dance moves, the way he moved his hips. Oh, so good.
Later, when I got to college, I had posters of Steve McQueen and Jean-Paul Belmondo and even David Hemmings from the movie Blowout, because I got kind of interested in art films and stuff. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about Steve McQueen, and maybe I only got the poster when I got to college, but I always thought Steve McQueen was something very intriguing, you know, even as a kid growing up.
I definitely agree.
And I actually had an experience where I came in very close contact with him after I'd gotten out of college. I was working at a talent kind of, it was like business manager's office up on Sunset Boulevard. And they had a big lobby there. And it was an old vintage building with the black and white tile. And one day, Steve McQueen rode his motorcycle into the lobby of the building.
Oh, my God.
and I was there. And, it was a real high point.
Only Steve McQueen could get away with something like that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they were all crazy about him. Yeah. So.
Did you grow up in a musical household?
I did. My uncle by marriage was a music producer, and he had been a big band leader like in the 1930s, and even wrote some songs during the 50s and 60s that he co-wrote them with people, and that some of them became hits. And he used to send me the 45 records, like stacks. And stacks. I don't know if you remember 45 records. They were, you know, slightly larger than a big pancake. And everybody had them, and you would play them on your hi-fi or whatever. So he would send me like Dion and the Belmonts and the Shirelles and a few other kind of, you know, the people that were the big hit songs from that period. And my mother was a torch singer she had a really big voice. I mean, she had studied opera, and she was a real rebel, and she started singing in nightclubs when she was 16. She lied about her age.
Oh, wow.
So, and later I had a recording of her, I don't have it anymore, where she was singing at Radio City Music Hall.
Wow. Cool.
But our voices could not be any more different. You know, it's like my influences are Tom Waits, Leonard Cohen, Lucinda Williams, and Bob Dylan. So
totally.
I basically sound like I'm at the bottom of a gravel pit. When I sing.
It's, we were talking about that. It's quite unique to hear a woman singing in that voice. It's so beautiful, and you don't see a lot of women singing like that.
But beautiful in a way that's different than your traditional.
Yeah.
Beautiful, what people think is a beautiful voice, yeah. But it's cool.
Yeah, it's mesmerizing. It's really nice.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. I used to be able to sing, but once I started, I mean, you know, sing more like a girl. But once I just felt that I started to inhabit that sort of persona, mm-hmm. It's like I can't go back. It's just who I am now.
I love that.
So speaking of who you are.
Yeah, we really liked your bio. You wrote that you were born with a transistor radio in one hand and a pen in the other. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? Like, have you always been writing music or writing in general?
Yeah, I've always been writing. My mother insisted, and I'm very grateful that she did, that I take piano lessons. So I started taking piano at age 5. And then my uncle was sending me all of this music, and I'm trying to remember everything. Oh, my aunt was a top script supervisor in New York City, and that's my mother's sister, and she's the one who was married to my uncle.
Cool.
And she did all the big New York movies, all the Academy Award winners, Splendor in the Grass and Failsafe and The Hustler and you name it, you know. Wow. And she would send me the screenplays. So I started reading the screenplays at an early age. But about 10 years ago, I went to my high school reunion, and people came up to me and said that they still had little short stories that I had written when I was in high school.
Nice.
So, I mean, even younger than high school, but yeah. So there was all of that. And, you know, I was like the first kid to have a transistor radio.
I love
and,
that.
You know, back then it was bubblegum pink, and it was pretty big, you know, it's kind of like when cell phones came out and they were just gigantic. So the first transistors were pretty good size. And I would be like on the tetherball court in, you know, in sixth grade or something, and have carrying that transistor radio with me, listening to songs from the, you know, 50s.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And cool family too.
Yeah. So speaking of cool, you have a degree in educational psychology. What made you pursue that route? And is there anything from that learning experience that you've taken with you throughout your life?
Well, I'm one of these people grateful for even some of the things that happen to you that aren't that pleasant at the time or whatever. But I feel like every experience you have contributes to who you are at the moment. And people have asked me if I would trade places with somebody or whatever. And I wouldn't, you know, life's not perfect, but it's who I am now. And I'm actually fairly proud of that. I ended up publishing. That was one of the first things of mine that ever got published was my master's thesis. It was published in the British Journal of Educational Psychology. And I looked it up recently online I looked it up really recently, but about 5 years ago, I looked it up and saw that somebody had written a book using, you know, using it and giving me credit. And I went and bought the book, and it was really cool. So, and it also prepared me because it was the British Journal of Educational Psychology that it was published in. I got letters from people all over the world, and I was only like 22, I think. And I was laughing, thinking that it prepared me for getting the letters from people all over the world that I've gotten since I wrote the book about Bob.
Aww. That's so remarkable. Aww. That's like, that's so exciting. Aww. Speaking as well of being published.
And of remarkable women.
Yes. Our podcast, of course, celebrates the voices and stories of women connected to music. And we were really fascinated to hear that you had written an article called In Defense of Yoko Ono. We recently did an episode on Cynthia Lennon, and some negative comments were left about Yoko on that post. And can you speak a little bit about the ongoing defense of Yoko, and why did you feel compelled to write that?
Wow. It's so hard to believe that, you know, people would still have a grievance at this late date. I mean, it's not very evolved, I think. But for me, I had been widowed myself at age 26. And I'd been married for 6 months when he got killed on the back of a friend of ours' motorcycle. Wow. And my upbringing, you know, was not the, you know, as cool as the family sounds. It was a very, very dysfunctional family. And by the time I was 26, which is the age I was when Ron was killed, I didn't have any parents left. And I was an only child. So to have this new guy that I had met a year and a half before and you know, decided that we were compatible enough to move forward in life, ripped from me at age 26, I was totally devastated. And I thought about, you know, it was so weird. I think I say in the book something like, even then the people around me became ghosts. And I was reminded of the Dylan line in Idiot Wind, where he says something like, people see me all the time and they just can't remember how to act. And that was suddenly how all these people that I had known for years became around me. And so I immersed myself in my work. And I had become a real estate agent to support my writing habit. I was never set up to, like, that wasn't my life's goal. It was a means to an end. But after my husband died, I started working like 80 hours a week. So for 26, 7, 8 years old, I started making a lot of money. And that really alienated me from friends, you know? And when it came out about Yoko, and when she released Season of Glass, I knew that just like me making a bunch of money selling real estate, when she made Season of Glass, it was just one artist's documentation of working through her grief and pain, you know? And I mean, I personally loved the record myself, but I just couldn't believe that people were so stung up. You hear they worship John Lennon, but vilified Yoko Ono, and yet John saw something in her that he truly loved. And now they're jumping onto a Cynthia Lennon thread, you know? Crazy.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. That was exactly it. Okay.
And it's really fascinating too, because no one said anything negative about John and his participation in things. And it, like, he's a grown man making his own decisions.
We didn't have tons of comments. It was a couple, like it was just a few, and they were both women that had said that.
It's just fascinating. That people
it's crazy.
yeah, still blaming Yoko for, you know, the split of the Beatles. Yeah, and the split between John and Cynthia, but it's like, this is John making choices.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
It's crazy.
Right. And, you know, he wasn't exactly playing with a full deck either, you know. You have to cut people some slack. There seemed to be this cultural division between people. It's kind of like between the nurturing mother who would understand somebody working through their grief and the punitive, strict father who would beat up on her psychologically. And women, there's a lot of women that have that personality too. It's like, you can't find a job, you know, it's your fault, or, you know, so many things. It's a very sad time right now.
So, yeah, totally. We have been talking so far about some of the things you've done, like your writing and your degree and the letters you've gotten from people. What are some of your proudest accomplishments? I know that you touched on that briefly, but anything else that you'd like to throw in there? We just want to celebrate you a little bit more before we really start getting into the book.
Truly, my biggest accomplishment was surviving my childhood. And, I had two narcissistic parents and we lived out in the middle of nowhere and I was an only child. So it was just me with these two kind of really insane people. And I did manage to cut out a pretty good path for myself in spite of it. And probably the second biggest was surviving Bob.
Wow.
I'll tell you what I'm proud of. I am proud of the fact that after surviving my childhood, after surviving Bob, and after surviving how many relationships as a woman because of my dysfunctional childhood that only lasted a year to 1.5 years, that I have finally been married for 25 years to the same man. I'm very proud of that.
Hell yeah, sister.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Survivor. Congratulations on 25 years. That's amazing. In our hands right now, we have a copy of Seeing the Real You at Last, Life and Love on the Road with Bob Dylan by Brita Lee Shane. Now, I just have to say, first of all, holding this book, the cover is amazing. The cover is amazing. The inside of the book, it's just like, even before reading it, I'm holding the book and it's sexy. The book looks sexy. Okay.
It feels good. It feels good too. It's kind of silky.
Oh, totally. So it's very, very attractive right off the bat. You obviously have very good style. Not only that, getting into the book, it was one of the funniest and sexiest rock memoirs that we've ever read. So for people it's true. For people who are fascinated with Bob Dylan, this is an intimate but lovely portrayal of this time in his life and your relationship together. It's a slow burn in terms of pacing. I loved the pacing and the timing of it. And then a bond kindling with eventual fiery encounters. Very so sexy. Nice. Can you speak about the writing process for you? And do you have any plans on publishing another novel or continuation, any more memoirs?
Okay. Well, I'll start at the beginning and work my way down. But as part of my journey to find peace within the chaos of that childhood I was telling you about, I had a spiritual teacher how old was I when I was? I was pretty old, like in my 30s, who recommended journaling as a therapeutic tool. So like 10 years after that, probably 10 years after that, but also 10 years after I had stopped traveling around the world, literally and figuratively, I might add, with Bob, I was stunned to realize I was still tangled up in him when the news broke on CNN that he had been hospitalized with a potentially fatal heart problem. So I thought that out of respect for my marriage, I'd been married for 5 years, and all of a sudden I was like hooked back in with Bob. And I thought, well, I need to do something about it. So my book started as a journal. It was just to myself. And the weirdest thing is, as soon as I put pen to paper, as it were, it kind of wrote itself. And, when I was done, I thought, wow, you couldn't make this stuff up. I mean, the arc of our story and all of that, it just all seemed to work really beautifully. So I was very proud of that. I had written another novel before then called Unsuspecting Heart that, at first, I had gotten I had had an agent, a New York agent for it. But believe it or not, memoirs were not a thing that people were into, even when I first finished the Dylan book. So I would call that book more of an autobiographical novel. It's about growing up in Hollywood in the 50s, and my dysfunctional childhood. And I'm really hoping later in the summer, which is only going to be another month or so, that I get back to take a look at that again and see what's there.
Awesome. Yeah, we definitely want to read more.
That's great.
So
thanks.
You went from being a fan to a friend, and then from a friend to a lover, to one of the most mythical music legends ever. What surprised you most about Bob when you entered his world?
Well, I was very insulated. He was very armored, I would say. And I didn't really do anything to change that. I think, I didn't like kiss up to him or anything. I just thought that, I even said to my boyfriend, wow, he's so guarded. or something like that. And he said, you don't understand. He has to be like that, you know? And I really didn't understand. I mean, fame is a huge burden. And it's amazing that he's still around, I've got to tell you, you know, compared to so many other icons that we've lost. So he must be doing something right in that regard. But once that shifted, we had, I had always had this feeling that we would get along, and we really did. I don't know how that happened. So he was very playful and romantic and funny. And then he wasn't.
Wow. God, that's a really, yep, poignant way to put it. But you're totally right. I'm reading yet another book about Elvis. And it's tough to, even though I know the story, it's tough to hear it again. And you're right. Just soaking that in. Okay. So, you know, just talking about this cover of the book and then just you and who you are, you do have incredible style, and you have given Bob, or you had given Bob, some incredible gifts when you knew him, like the Bob Dylan shirt and like clothing that he loved. Have you always been a good gift giver? Are you like that with everybody?
No. That's funny you should ask that. I, you know, as time has gone on, time just seems to go faster and faster. So I still will spend hours making something for somebody, but it has to be a person that I care about enormously, you know. It's just, you know, time is too limited, but I love it. You know, it's just another outlet for creativity. And the same thing with throwing parties.
Yes. We wanted to ask, do you still throw awesome parties?
I do. I just, and for my, I'm not going to say how old, birthday. And that was a big smash hit. But my, my CD release parties were so amazing. They were just, you know, we had an incredible time. I have this friend named Sharon who I could practically go into business with as like eccentric party planners. And she co-produced my CD releases with me because I like to curate everything, you know, right down to, you know, oh my God, you know, the crumbs that are left after the cake is eaten on the table or whatever. So anyway, the first CD release party that I had, it was actually, I'm sorry, it was the CD release and the book. I had a combined party for that, and it was at this fabulous vintage and children's jewelry store in Pasadena. And it was on, you know, two levels, and we had this great stage, and I had a full band and everything, and we had the most incredible food ever. But the point is, and I had all these pictures of Dylan blown up, and, you know, it was really, it was very perfect. But anyway, but we had a custom cake made that was iced with Dylan's 1960s face on it, smoking a cigarette.
Oh, man. Do you have photos of that?
I do. Yeah, sure. Gotta
see this.
Yeah, it was great. And then the next one, Sharon made these little plastic, she had these plastic, she found these figurines that were like silhouettes almost with a male and a female guitar player. And she made one of them Bob Dylan and the other one me. So,
so cute.
Anyway, we have fun. We have fun when we do these things, and it's all in the details. And
oh, totally.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, well, from one great party thrower and planner to another, I went out to a show. My friend's band was in town. And, yeah, they reminded me of the awesome parties I used to throw. And I met somebody who was like, oh, yeah, I think I was at a party at your house years ago. Like, I think you probably were, my friend.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, those parties that I threw with Ernie with the, you know, where Bob would show up, or we'd have a Cadillac in the driveway with the top down as extra seating for people to sit at, you know, yeah, that kind of stuff is fun and really takes your mind off of what's, you know, what's ailing you.
Yeah, that's really cool. And if anybody listening to this now is curious to learn more about those, and they should definitely read your book. Everybody should read that book.
Thanks.
So, can you talk more about your musical career? You had mentioned that it was a CD release as well as a book release.
Right. Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I started playing the piano when I was 5. So I knew how to read music, and I played all the way until I was 16 when I got too cool. I thought it wasn't cool to play the piano. So I'm an idiot. And then, like, in 1971, I went to see Carole King open for James Taylor at the Troubadour in Los Angeles.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, oh, my God, right? And so my mother took me to McCabe's the next day and bought me this little classical guitar. It was in Australia. They still make those. But so I took guitar lessons and stuff. But my mother was so strict with me and so critical. And when she passed away in 72, but her voice just kept living through me. And so after a couple of years of playing the guitar, I gave it up because I thought, I never was going to be great at it. Well, guess what? If I had kept playing all those years, I'd be a lot better than I am today. But I do enough musically with my instrument to support my lyrics, and I've always loved lyrics. But it was not even when I was with Bob. It was 87, you know, 15 years after that, I think, that we had a dog, my favorite dog, Cisco, who I had gotten as a puppy, and he was a champion Malamute mixed with a Samoyed and a wolf.
Whoa.
And he was just the most gorgeous, loving, but rambunctious, you know, I mean, the troublemaker. And anyway, he died at age 7, which was way too young. And my husband and I realized that this dog was kind of what was holding us together in some way. You know, everything was focused around the dog at that point. And all of a sudden, the dog was gone. And my husband that played mandolin when he was a kid. He had learned how to play mandolin from an old vaudevillian in Hollywood that lived across the street from him. So, and I had this guitar. And all of a sudden, you know, we started playing old Bob Dylan songs and Beatles songs and doing all this stuff. And one day I just wrote a song, and that was the beginning of it. And somehow I've managed to accrue a small fan base. I mean, when I play out, it's a pretty good house. So
that's so amazing. And I love that, like, the music brought you guys together and everything. Oh. You did.
Yeah.
You did, however, have a unique experience with Bob. You wrote a song with him?
Yeah, well, that was pretty crazy because I'm not sure I mentioned that, you know, as a kid, like re-kid on the piano, I would write little pop songs or whatever. But when I knew Bob, I was a screenwriter. I was, had a screenplay with an agent that was going out and around town and stuff. And, I was just so in awe of him, when I found myself sitting on the floor in a hotel room with just him and his guitar and a notepad. So sometimes I was just like so in awe of him, I could hardly say anything. And he's like, "You write the words. I didn't use them right."
Brita, you write the lyrics.
And I was very intimidated. Since then, I've learned that the fastest way to get to the heart of a song is to throw whatever comes into your mind on the page and then toss it later if it doesn't work. And I did wind up writing the last verse to our song by myself, 15 years later or something. And you'd be shocked at how many people say it's their favorite verse. So,
yeah, Brita. Very cool.
You're putting that out there, but my favorite, when I do my CD release and readings and stuff, my last reading is always 8 words before a song that I wrote. Well, before I do the rendition of Make You Feel My Love, which is one of my favorite latter day songs of Bob's. And my 8 word reading is, "Brita, Brita, I love you, I love you." That's all the introduction that song gets.
Oh, it doesn't need any more than that. And cue the song. That's so cool. Mm-hmm. We recently interviewed Alice Carbone Tench, who is married to Benmont Tench of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. You had a relationship with Bob at the same time he was on tour with the Heartbreakers, which is so cool. Are there any memorable moments?
Great.
I'm sure there are many, but just because I know I read it in your book, but because I'm such a fan, I'd like to hear it from you. Any memorable moments that you'd like to share?
I was not a big fan of the Dead when he did the Dead tours, it was so heavy. It was just something. It didn't speak to me spiritually, but when he was with the Heartbreakers, they were an incredible, they just offered him so much support that it just buoyed his performances. But I do remember one night, Bob had me make the set list, and he did it a few times, but this particular night he had me write the set list and out of the blue, I asked him, I said, would you play Desolation Row for me? And he like groaned, and then he goes, "We haven't rehearsed it, And so, then I was like worried that, that I'd offended him or something, And then that night we get out there, and at some point, without even telling the Heartbreakers, he just launches into Desolation Row.
Aww.
And now that I'm a musician, I can kind of go back and think about what that performance was like, because it takes mentally, like the Petty Band, they've got to go, "Oh, okay, and what did I ever know about this song? And maybe I'll play it now, or maybe not," So there was like this tentativeness at the beginning with everyone except for Benmont. He knew that song in his soul.
Yep. Yeah, he did.
And I was standing behind him on stage watching him, and he was always my favorite to stand beside anyway, because I was, born with a piano apparently in my hand as well. So Benmont was completely unfazed, and he just hammered hammered the whole thing home. That whole thing came together, and it was really a high point. And apparently that song hadn't been played in years by Bob. So maybe he really did love me.
Yeah, I find it amazing that he like allowed you to choose his set list. That's so awesome. That's so special.
Well, it's also intoxicating, you know. It's very, intoxicating to be in the eyes of someone that you practically worship, you know, and having them look upon you so glowingly that you're like mesmerized, you're possessed.
Oh yeah.
In my case, you know. Yeah. But you know what I wanted to mention to you? I looked Alice up online and her book looks amazing. Did you guys read it?
We have. It's so good. We definitely recommend if you can find it. I think she said she's going to try to publish it again.
I don't know. She was saying things about she struggled with it a little bit. She had felt some shame over it. It wasn't the title that she had wanted. And I know that there are some very like personal and autobiographical things in it. She needs to give herself more credit.
Oh, yeah. It's an incredible book.
Because it actually is a really incredible book. But if you read it, you'll see how sort of vulnerable you have to be to write something like that. So I really like, and I'm so happy that we get to talk to you and about who you are and the accomplishments that you've done that have just been, you know, just so much more than just being in a relationship with Bob Dylan for a moment in time, but just so you're so much more. And so is she, right? She's so interesting and fascinating and vulnerable. And it's so nice that everybody is being exposed to their writing and your music and stuff like that. So it's what we're really trying to do over here.
I can't wait to hear it.
So what brings you joy now? How are you spending your days? Are you working on anything? Any new music coming?
Or just zenning out?
Oh, no. Zen not in my repertoire. I'm tried to make a conscious effort to be slightly zenned out before we spoke, but I seem to have projects. I'm just somebody who has projects, and it doesn't matter whether it's helping a friend plan a party or, you know, I need to go through and edit all my pictures on my computer because I love photography. I take pictures of birds. I'm a birder. And I know that's really nerdy, I'm sure. But man, when you live out in these natural places and you see these birds, it's just such a reminder of what our world is really about, you know? But I did just write a song. The thing is that I don't know if you've noticed, but the U.S. is in terrible decline.
Oh, yeah.
At least from my perspective. And not only that, our planet is in decline.
Also
so,
noticed.
You know, I'm very much focused on politics these days. There's this fabulous thing called Postcards to Voters, where you actually you buy a blank postcard and you draw on it before you send it out to voters to get them to go. You know, you might, like in my case, do vote in 1960s script, even with peace symbols or whatever. So that, you know, you can work out a lot of grief, but apparently, I mean, they've been really successful. So I highly recommend that to anybody who's listening, Postcards to Voters. And I am in the process of co-producing with a friend. We're going to do three benefit concerts for Rock the Vote.
Amazing.
And they'll be on the smaller side, like 10 artists per bit, and a little bit closer to the election. to give these organizations who are getting people to the polls and all of that sort of thing a little extra boost. So my latest song is an anthem, and I don't want to give it away, but the gist of it is we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore.
Yes.
And it's a sing along. So we're copywriting it today as we speak. So
nice.
Very cool. We can't wait to sing along.
Yeah. You're thinking of like really fun ways. Really fun ways to, you know, participate in politics and get people out there voting and everything. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I've read something that said this next election is not between the candidates. It's between democracy and fascism. So I think we better get our people out.
This is definitely an important one.
Oh God, I can't as Canadians, we're just like, you know, sitting by and watching the flames, and it's, you know, we feel helpless, like not a lot that we can do. I mean, it's interesting to participate in conversations and also be knowledgeable about our own politics and the relationships that they play and like together with Canada and the US. But really, thank you for doing something like that. And
Everyone
we'll
in Canada is supporting you guys right now, and you know, you'll get through this.
I hope so. I mean, about another two more years. I don't know if I can survive that, but
yeah, it's pretty sickening.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
It is. It's toxic.
Yeah.
It's toxic, and yet you can't totally stick your head in the sand, because at any minute you might have to hop on a plane to Washington, D.C., or at least get, like, from here to Los Angeles, you know, to protest, so.
There's this, so our network, Rock and Roll Archaeology, they are out in San Francisco, and they have a studio in Hollywood, but they interviewed Amit Zappa, who is Frank Zappa's son. And one of the questions they asked him was, what do you think your father would say about the current political situation? And Amit replied, I think he's already said it.
Well, you know, believe it or not, I used to think that Frank Zappa should run for office.
Yeah,
I mean, his politics were, you know, and his voice was so remarkable. I had a great experience with Mr. Zappa, not close up and personal, but when I was hitchhiking across Europe in 1970 with my girlfriend, we wound up in Amsterdam. I don't think I mentioned it in the book. Maybe in the next edition, but since it is all rock and roll or whatever. But we went into this club called the Paradise Club. Someone told me many years ago that it was still there. I don't know that it's there anymore. But it was like this big, gigantic room, and you sat on the floor and basically partook of whatever was being passed by you at the time. And they said that they had a special guest. I mean, it was so random that we were there that night, and they were passing these joints that were the size of cigars, and they were half tobacco is the way they would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody was just completely open-hearted to receive whatever came to them. And what came to us was Frank Zappa in Amsterdam, and he did an entire show.
Oh my God.
It was
amazing.
Really
talk about being in the right place at the right time.
I know, right? Yeah. So
it's always interesting when experiences like that happen where you're from the same city, like you're so close, yet you have to go all the way over to Europe to, you know, see them in this incredible, like, randomness. When that happens.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, there's advantages and disadvantages to the world being as small as it. You were talking about Canada, and you know, my publisher for the book is in England. And they're completely distraught about what's happening here also, as they should be. So,
yeah. We're all distraught.
Anyways,
and I think
both.
This has been a long time coming. This didn't just happen overnight. And, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again. You know, our young people are very, very awake to what's happening, whereas I think I pretty much slept through all of that stuff as a child and as a teen, and really wasn't even until my late 20s, early 30s that I started listening up and paying attention to what was happening, whereas that's just not the case anymore. So there's two more years of him, but there's a really wonderful generation of children coming forwards, I think. So let's just hope that our future is bright, but we just need to
get through this.
Yeah. I mentioned the Parkland kids in my song. I'm hoping to make a video, too, so I'll make sure you guys get copied in on all of it.
We love that. And speaking of your music, now that listeners have got to know you more and hopefully feel inspired to go get your book, where can they find your music and purchase your CDs or anything that you've got to sell?
Yeah. Well, the latest CD, it's called What the Heart Wants, has the song I wrote with Bob on it. And that song's called You Can Blow My Mind If You Want To. And it's a really fun, sexy song. And it has also, there's like, you know, I have the cover of Make You Feel My Love, and then a couple of songs that I wrote for him. There are some people who think every song in the album is about him, and that's just not true. But it's available on CD Baby, iTunes, Amazon, and my website.
Perfect.
And my book, Seeing the Review at Last, Life and Love on the Road with Bob Dylan, can be found at Amazon and other outlets, too, as either a paperback or an ebook. But I sell personally signed first editions on my website, BritaLeeShane.com.
Excellent.
We'll definitely link that up on our site as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. And, you know, we read so many autobiographies, we read so many books, and I can really say from the bottom of my heart that yours was, in, is, will be one of my all-time favorites. So thank you for sharing it. Thank you for putting it out there. Thank you for everything that you're doing. And it's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you. Take care, you guys.
All right. We'll talk to you very soon.
Bye, Brita.
And vote.
Yes. Yes.
Big light, baby, but when you shut it down, my whole world goes gray, murky, I can't hear a sound. I try my best to get to you, but you just disappear. Some people think that you're a star, I just think you're weird.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait. The excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.